ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to A Big Country. I'm David Claughton. And it's lovely to have your company as we join our reporters exploring regional Australia. This week, we're learning about a study of bumblebees on Tasmanian farms, where the pollinators are being fitted with tiny backpacks holding radio transmitters to track their movements. We'll hear about a new way of getting fresh milk from the farm to the cafe or shop without the use of plastic bottles. And we'll meet researchers who are passionate about finding the next variety of one of Australia's favourite summer fruits.
At the end of the day, I love passion fruit. It's my favourite thing to work with. It tastes good and I eat far too much of it, so I feel sick sometimes. I'll be out in the field. Every fruit that I see, I have to try. It's all good. I love it.
A passion for passion fruit. We'll hear why new varieties of the fruit are desperately needed. That's coming up. First today, we're heading to the New South Wales Northern Tablelands, where a small property is believed to be the only place in the world where a unique and critically endangered yellow shrub grows. Reporter Bridget Murphy ventured into the bush to learn more about the rare plant.
After about an hour of walking, ducking and manoeuvring through bushland on Stephen Walkden Brown's property, Loma Langi, a bright yellow cluster appears in the distance. We've spotted the critically endangered Astralasia rupestris, specifically this flower's subspecies, Recurva. Here near Armidale in the state's northern tablelands is the only place in the world where this plant grows. Stephen and his wife Yvonne bought the 200-hectare property in 2017. Unbeknownst to them, alongside its almost untouched bushland, it housed the critically endangered species. Ben Vincent is a senior regional conservation officer with the Biodiversity Conservation Trust. He says very little is known about the shrub.
There's really little known about its life history, so there's plenty still to learn. It's critically endangered, that's its listing in New South Wales. And to get that listing, you have to be a plant with a very, very restricted geographic location, of which this one has. It's probably about 600 metres in length along a creek line and restricted to the Parlour Mountains there. And it also has to have very few mature individuals.
Although it's a small and relatively simple-looking plant from afar, Mr. Vincent says for those with a trained eye, it's striking.
The heart-shaped green leaves full of these little star-shaped hairs, which make it kind of a fluffy, light green appearance. And then this, you know, beautiful, really obvious yellow flower. They really do stand out.
Stephen agrees. He says he is proud to consider himself a custodian to the plant.
I think it does help that they are quite an attractive plant, a little bit bushy in the wild, but they have a very bright yellow, very distinctive and nice flowers. There's a number of conservation efforts in hand. And yes, the fact that it's a lovely plant and where it grows is also nice along the creek banks in amongst some leptospermum overcover with in amongst grass and things. So, yeah, just walking through it and seeing these bright splashes of yellow when it's flowering. But even the non-flowering plant, it's got a sort of a furry grey-green leaf that maybe it's an acquired taste, but knowing it's so rare, we think they look quite nice as well.
Mr. Vincent says despite its critical situation, there could be a prosperous future for the plant, with a survey this year showing good signs.
We were able to get out and resurvey the existing population and find the mature adults are about the same. So that's great. It means they're persisting well. But the exciting news was to see, I think we counted about over 600. So that's a great outcome. And these guys are, you know, they're probably 20 or 30 centimetres tall. So the point there is that they've been in the landscape now for probably 4 or 5 years and persisting well. So it's a good news story for this critically endangered species.
It was believed, like so many other Australian natives, fire was needed to break seed dormancy. But it appears in this case, drought was the catalyst.
It was thought prior to this resurvey that this plant species, like many Australasia, needed fire in the landscape to break seed dormancy. And that may be the case, but as it turns out, severe drought like that which we experienced in 2018 and into the end of 19 appears to also break dormancy. So, you know, the Australian flora is adapted to boom and bust drought situations like we had.
Mr. Vincent says private landholders like Mr. Walkden Brown play a pivotal role in biodiversity and conservation.
Private landholders are becoming more aware of what the Biodiversity Conservation Trust does in New South Wales, and which is partner with private landholders to achieve conservation outcomes on their property. And yeah, look, I think it is becoming more popular.
As part of his work with the state's Biodiversity Conservation Trust, Stephen receives funding to do his part caring for the plants.
We do notice that some of them are being nibbled, and we do have deer up on this block, and there's feral goats as well. And so we're under our contract with BCT. We are obliged to try and control those species, which pose some kind of threat. The population's fairly healthy. We keep a watching brief on it, and we're just so pleased that there are so many little seedlings because we've had, this is probably the fourth, at least the fourth, maybe going on for the fifth year of above average rainfall or pretty good season. So after the 2019 drought, it was terrible up here, but the plant seems to have responded to that run of good seasons.
Just like Stephen and Yvonne inherited the beautiful endangered species, they also hope to pass it on, ensuring the plant is cared for in the future.
Got one of our children lives in Armidale and has a number of kids, so you know we would like this to pass on through the family after we've gone. That'll be their decision, but we love it. We come up here often. The kids and grandkids come up as well, and it's a very favourite spot.
Like many cafes, this busy outlet in the coastal Tasmanian town of Penguin powers through milk on a daily basis. The milk is delivered weekly, in bulk, ready to supply caffeine-starved customers with their daily dose. But unlike other cafes, this milk comes in a keg and it's pulled out of a tap. This pub-like setup is a deliberate choice.
So it's something we've been looking at for a couple of years now.
Cafe co-owner Rob Avia speaking here. He had some misgivings about the system.
The main hurdle had been cost at the start. So when we first went to market looking, when we first acquired the shop, the cost was around $12,000 to install a tap, which for a small business was completely unattainable. But fast forward to, I'm trying to think when this went in now, but it's been for longer than a year.
The way he describes it is a bit like a vending machine. The cafe is responsible for the daily cleaning and refilling, but the supplier owns the infrastructure and is in charge of all the maintenance and milk deliveries.
So that made it accessible for us, which was great.
It's more expensive than mass-produced plastic bottles from a large dairy factory, and that's hard to pass on to a consumer. But cafe manager Grace Primrose reckons the benefits outweigh the costs.
All right, so we're looking at a fridge which is hooked up with our kegs inside, and then we've got a milk tap where people can come and bring in their litre refills and refill every day fresh.
And you also use this in the coffees?
Yeah, definitely. So we fill up separate kegs that are 2 litres each and go and put them in the coffees, and it just makes the creamiest coffee.
What's it like to use, I don't know if you've used a system where you've got milk bottles instead.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What's the comparison?
It's just fresher, and since we're like topping it up every couple of minutes when we go through the litres, you're just getting like fresher milk in your coffee. People definitely notice the milk and then come in and want to get the refills. They want to hear the story, they want to hear who's behind it, and yeah.
People really value knowing where the milk comes from. To Grace's point about the story, knowing that it comes from a single farm, people are willing to pay for that privilege. Something we're really proud about is the waste. So over a year, it's about 8,000 plastic bottles that don't come through our store anymore, which is incredible.
Yeah, I've worked in cafes my whole life that have the plastic bottles, and it's quite frustrating when you have to try and get them down small enough to go in the bin, and then you are using so much waste. So it's nice that we can return the kegs, wash to him, and then he can refill them for us.
And the farmer that does that refilling Well, about 100 kilometres down the road, Gennaro Velasquez makes boutique Venezuelan-style cheese on what he reckons is one of the smallest dairy farms in Tasmania.
We milk our own cows, so we milk 100 cows, and we produce more milk than what we put towards cheese.
The solution? A couple of years ago, he started selling off his fresh milk both directly to customers and to a large nearby milk factory.
And so by having milk, like in cakes or pre-filled bottles and plastic bottles, and then we also have skim milk and cream and things like that, it just brings security to our business. So it allows us to value add.
Dairy farmers generally sell their milk to these giant, often global processors, meaning they have little to no say over what price they get. And while Gennaro still sells some milk to a processor, he's been able to cut out the middleman for the rest, processing it on farm, choosing his own prices, and directly receiving profits from sales.
Any milk that we are able to process through the factory and sell it as a value-added product, it is milk that we are not relying on what the commodity price or the commodity or the industry in general wants to say our milk is worth. In a small business scenario like us, like milking 100 cows, to make it viable and to make it profitable and to make it sustainable in the long run, we have to look at ways of value adding and doing all these things that are pretty much thinking out of the box.
Each week, Gennaro's farm sends out milk to about 20 customers, including popular cafes. Some of it's in glass bottles, some's in plastic bottles, and since introducing it last year, about half is in these reusable milk kegs.
It's sort of like our contribution to looking after the environment, reducing that use of single-use plastic. We started using this system back in April 2024.
Not everyone loves them, but his share of customers is increasing.
I guess for some people and for some operations, it's easier just to stick to plastic. You just get the plastic, fill up the bottles, they go, and you don't have to know about them. As I said, people that care about the environment, that don't want to be using plastic bottles and don't want to be generating more rubbish than what we need to, so we have a number of cafes that are now moving towards that, because same thing, like you have the environmental contribution, but you also make it a lot easier for them. Once they're up, like set up and ready to go, it makes it a lot easier for them.
And for customers like Rob Arvia at the cafe, there's something charming about having a local farmer come and drop their milk right at the door.
Yeah, it's incredible. And obviously we are farmers first and foremost. So to have those connections and also for those people to be directly interacting with the team here, it's just invaluable. Wouldn't have it any other way.
Farmer and cafe owner Rob Arvia ending that report from Meg Ferguson. Before that, Brigitte Murphy took us into the bush in the New South Wales Northern Tablelands, where a rare plant is thriving. And you can see more on that story, including pictures of the native shrub with a pretty yellow flower, on the ABC homepage at abc.net.au. I'm David Claughton with you for A Big Country. Still to come, the researchers tracking bumblebees in Tasmania with the help of some high-tech equipment. And if you love passion fruit on top of your summer pav, you'll be pleased to know work is underway to develop new varieties to keep the fruit growing in Australia. Jennifer Nichols has this story from the Passion Fruit Research Patch on Queensland's Sunshine Coast.
It's a beautiful flower that we're looking at.
Yeah, you can see the blue colour here, and it is beautiful. And yeah, we use this one. One of the reasons is if we can identify this is tolerant to different stresses, like high temperature. Yeah, hello, Mubashir Alam. So you can call me Mo. I'm leading National Passion Fruit Breeding Program.
You're doing some very important work, because the plants that growers have been using, there's some problems with them.
Yes, for the varieties, yield decline is happening. The size of the fruits are getting reduced. Growers are not making much profit. We want to release new varieties that are profitable for the industry, that can produce optimum fruit size, that have good flavor.
What's involved in breeding passion fruit?
The first thing is really important. We should have good germplasm. So that's the collection of these different varieties that have different good traits. We call it germplasm, and you can call it genetic resource. Unfortunately, we didn't have when we started the breeding program, but our team did a fantastic job, and we collected a lot of germplasm within Australia and from abroad as well. So that's the way we expanded our genetic resources, and that also helped us to develop new varieties quickly. And then we have selected nearly 20 new accessions for the industry at this moment. We'll see how do they grow in grower's plot in next year.
So the accessions are the different genetic results of different seeds?
Yes, results of differences. Even if we have collected from the same plant, these seeds are different. So that one we have selected is an accession.
So when did this project start?
Started in April 2023. But we believe we made a good progress because at genetic resources we expanded over the last 2 years, and we selected some new promising accessions for the industry. Usually within 1 year we select one plant only. So then from one plant we are multiplying. We have multi-location trials, so that gives us more opportunity to multiply them to apply in commercial orchard.
So in the plant world, this is pretty speedy.
It is much better than macadamia. I have been working with macadamia as well. It took 24 years to release a variety. But here, hopefully within 3 years, we'll be able to select a good one. And within 5 years, we'll be able to give it to the growers. So it's very fast.
Dr. Mo Alam from the University of Queensland. Patrick Mason is another researcher from the University of Queensland. You've been involved in this work too?
Yes. I actually moved from a more of a fundamental genetics background to Mo's lab, which is very much involved in breeding, macadamia, and more recently passion fruit. So I've actually only been here for a year and a half, but at the end of the day, I love passion fruit. It's my favourite thing to work with. It tastes good, and I eat far too much of it, so I feel sick sometimes. I'll be out in the field. Every fruit that I say I have to try. It's all good. I love it.
Well, I guess the passion for passion fruit is a good thing to have when you're researching them.
Absolutely. Yeah, I just hope that trying all the fruits that I've been doing, hopefully it ends up with a good result for the farmers and good quality fruit for the consumer.
It's challenging to be a farmer with all of the impacts of extreme weather, rising costs of production. How crucial is this work to passion fruit still being grown in Australia?
Oh, it's very crucial. The industry is very much over-reliant on a small set of varieties. And so there has been a little bit of work by some other breeders who are farmers, but they've done a bit of breeding work, like Keith Paxton, for example. He's produced a couple of good varieties. But at a fundamental level, we can't be reliant on just a couple of varieties for the entire industry because there's a lot of different areas. They've all got different disease pressures and different climatic zones. And so you need to have, I'd say, a large number of accessions that farmers can pull from so they can really cater production to their farm and use varieties that work best in their farm. So it's very crucial, and moving forward, they're going to need a constant stream of varieties available. So one of the other issues that we have in the passion fruit industry is that it's a clone. So when you've got your good variety, you're basically taking cuttings from that and you're producing something that is exactly the same, it's genetically similar. But over time, kind of like humans develop cancer and other things, you know, you get little mutations in your genome. Sort of a similar thing happens with plants as well, where they'll develop these mutations, and over time that'll affect productivity. So if you continue to do lots and lots of cloning, you'll produce these somaclonal mutations, and that affects production. And that's actually happened. Two of the most popular varieties, which have been fantastic back in the 90s, Sweetheart and Misty Gem, everyone was using them, everybody loved them. Nowadays, they're basically unusable. The fruit size is too small and the productivity is poor as well. So we've had to move away from those. And so that just shows how important it is to have new varieties constantly coming through to keep that productivity up. And again, that will ensure that the farmer's bottom line will be maintained. We're lucky to have two varieties at the moment that are in their advanced stages, and with a congregation of passion fruit farmers, we've put out calls for them to trial these varieties on their property. And so once we see interest and they're happy with these particular varieties, if that is the case, then we can go through the process of getting it protected with plant breeders' rights, and then we can release it to the broader passion fruit industry and they can start growing. And so we're hoping to do that by the end of 2027.
Usually they use the leaves. Oh, here she is. Here is the receiver. That is the radio transmitter.
The backpack is... It's secured, it hasn't moved at all. That's good.
So yeah, we need to wait her to completely wake up, and eventually she will go back to foraging so that she can restock energy. Usually what we need to see is that queens have pollen on their bodies, and when they start looking for pollen, they are looking for lipids and proteins, which means that they already have a nest, and they will eventually get new workers and the colony will grow during the summer. Well, my name is Eduardo Calderon, and I am working with my colleague Maria Escobedo. I am a PhD student and Maria is a master's student. We are studying at Western Sydney University and we are doing our research on bumblebee ecology in Tasmania, which is an introduced species here in the island. They were introduced here in 1992. It is estimated that they were only introduced two queens, and it was those two queens which actually populated the whole island, which is impressive. They are really successful here. We are trying to see what are the impacts of these new species, the good ones and also the bad ones, maybe, to see how they are doing in different ecosystems and different habitats. Basically, we are focusing on the nesting side of these bees to see how successful they are, how many workers are born in different nesting sites.
How productive they are.
Yeah, exactly. Our project is funded by Hort Innovation, and we are also collaborating with the Tasmanian government and University of Tasmania to cover different factors and different elements of this species.
So we're on a pepperberry farm today at Underwood.
Yeah, exactly. We are working on pepperberry farms and also in some raspberry farms. We are trying to see how they interact not only with introduced species but also with native species such as mountain pepperberry. We are trying to see if they are foraging only on introduced European species plants or if they are using actual native resources from Tasmania. So let's see what we can find out.
These bumblebees are wearing special backpacks.
We put them in their bags to track them. We find them foraging in flowers. We capture them and put them to sleep using some ice. We glue these little backpacks on their backs, and we track them back to their nest to see where they are, how they are doing.
Got an antenna?
Yeah, we have an antenna, and the receiver is like a little circuit that keeps making like a little loop.
That's what we can hear in the background. Yeah, the beep, exactly. Beep sound. Yeah, the static.
Yeah, exactly. It's a little beep that gets louder as we get closer to the bumblebees. At the moment, it is spring, so we are only looking for queens because they have an annual life cycle. During the whole spring, the queens are foraging to give birth to new eggs, to new workers. And in the summer, the workers emerge and they start foraging. The colony grows and stays like that the whole summer and most of the autumn. And by the end of autumn, the workers start to feed new eggs to create new queens, which will eventually leave the nest. That nest will die, the nest that we're talking about, like the old nests die, and the new queens emerge, go out, try to search for new places to rest during the winter, and the cycle goes back to the beginning.
From your research, can you see if these bumblebees are competing with native bees, with honeybees? Do you ever see them on the same plant together or the same bush?
I think that at the moment we cannot say because we need more data to actually sustain if they are competing. But yeah, definitely they are foraging the same flowers. I don't know. We don't know if there is an actual competition between them. Maybe there's just enough floral resources. But yeah, we still need to collect more data to actually know that. We will see. That's what this project is about, to see if they are competing or not with native species or with honeybees.
That's Eduardo Calderon tracking bumblebees on a peppermint farm at Underwood in northern Tasmania, where he spoke to Larissa Smith. For more on that story and all the stories you've heard on today's program, head online to the ABC homepage at abc.net.au. And that's the show for today. I'm David Claughton, and I'll catch up with you again next week with more great stories from regional Australia. I'll chat to you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.